I think I am glad that Lewis doesn't just throw Shasta into the battle and then, oh, and Shasta killed two Kalormans and Shasta's doing, you know.
Well, that's what Lewis does in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where Peter, you know, he's fighting so fast with the witch, it looked like three swords and three knives.
Welcome to Talking Beasts
from NarniaWeb.com,
where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis
and keep a watchful eye
on the latest Narnia movie news.
This
is Talking Beasts.
All right, you ready to rock and roll?
Let's do it.
Ready to on to Anvard?
On to Anvard, to Narnia and the North.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I am your host, Rillian.
And I'm Glumpuddle. You're still Rillian, I'm still Glumpuddle, and it's still the Talking Beast
podcast. I'm still Rillian. I am sleep deprived, and I've got a million things going on. Like, you know, we were just discussing, it's kind of funny how you guys get a little glimpse into our own lives just because, you know, sometimes it's like, hey, man, these guys are spot on. And then maybe sometimes if we seem distracted, it's because, yeah, we have lives too.
You know, sometimes the podcasts seem really good and sometimes they're not so good. And, well, we'll see what happens. I'd complain about being tired, but I'm not nearly as tired as you. I know that for a fact. So I won't complain about being tired.
That's okay. I'm two cups of coffee in for my evening coffee. So in the previous chapter, that was a great discussion. So mm-hmm. much happened there. Of course, Shasta met King Loon, and King Loon thinks that Shasta was Corrin. And Shasta joins King Loon and his party onto Anvard and gets separated and finds Rabadash's army, almost gets discovered there. And then Shasta meets Aslan.
I was the lion.
An incredible chapter. And it really kind of sets up, that's almost an emotional climax in the story there. But we move on to chapters 12 and 13. And in this segment, I even wrote in my notes, Shasta falls in with the Narnians. It in some ways reminds me a little bit of Prince Caspian, where Shasta kind of gets this whole episode of discovering more Narnians. And we kind of get a break from the action. We spend some time on food. But Shasta meets some more of the Narnians. The dwarves take Shasta in. And some of the Narnians start to spread the word. The stag runs off to warn Caer Paravel and let them know what's going on. And then we kind of run back into the Narnians, and Shasta meets Corrin again. And really, it's kind of this segue for them into the battle, as they both kind of AON into the battle.
Got to get a battle there somewhere, right? I'm kidding. Why am I so cynical about Narnia tonight? What is going on?
I don't know.
I'm just tired.
I don't know. You are tired. And what's interesting
is... I like this book. It's my second favorite Narnia book, for the record.
As the two boys go into the battle, it's kind of interesting. We get this shift back to the Hermit and Bree and Wynn and Aravis as they watch the battle. So we kind of get this view into the battle through the eyes of our other heroes. Mm-hmm. And...
we get the audio commentary on it.
Yeah, and they do this own kind of commentary, almost like they're describing the battle, not the narrator anymore.
Yeah.
Or really, it's mm-hmm. the Hermit describing the battle, because they can't even see the battle. And so some people, I think, were kind of perplexed why we even asked this on the Talking Beast Facebook group.
Looking at you, RJ.
But we asked, hey, how does the battle actually fit in to the Horse and His Boy? How does it fit into the story? Because this is really... almost like the biggest battle in all of the Chronicles of Narnia.
Well, except for maybe the last battle.
But even, you know, though in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, there is a big battle that takes place. It's only, it's very short.
It's just the punchline.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we asked, and here's some of our comments. Natalie said, the battle does continue a running theme with Shasta in that he's often in situations where he's completely incompetent and fumbling, but tries to do his best anyway and comes through.
Little Bilbo Baggins there.
Little Bilbo Baggins. Cody said, and I thought this was kind of interesting, he said, it's not my favorite part of the book or anything, but I don't find it distracting or bad or anything. And then Kyle said, to me, it's a bit distracting when it lost focus on Shasta. In Trumpets, the Horse and His Boy 2015 theater adaption, they tweaked it a bit, having Aravis, Bree, and Wynn join the battle after a full overnight recovery with the Hermit. Shasta and Aravis shared an in-battle kiss.
What?
and giving Shasta a chance to combat Rabadash after threatening Erebus. That's when Shasta slipped through the battlement gaps, landed safely down, leaving Rabadash caught through the gaps in the battlements because of his oversized armor. That's an interesting way.
So I hasten to add, that was the Horse and His Boy stage play that was done in Australia. That was not the one at the Logos Theater.
Yes, thank you for pointing that out. The one at the Logos Theater actually was done depicted very similarly to the book, where it is through the prism of...
And it worked well. Like they've got the big hill. They had this really big hill, but one of the coolest sets. The big hill with the Hermit of the Southern March and Erebus and the others. And they're looking into the pool. And below them, you see the battle kind of playing out. And we understand this is happening in two separate locations. And there's even a bit of humor. It's like, you know, Shasta has no clue what to do with his sword. And, of course, sure enough, you see the actor just, you know, waving around cluelessly. So there was some humor. They kind of worked some humor into there, too.
Yeah. But you and I were – I was kind of actually surprised when I got your text earlier today about the battle. Because it was kind of interesting because I'm reading the comments and people seem to think – the battle either it works okay or no, I love the battle. I kind of want you to go first because I feel like I would just be preaching to the choir if I said, oh yes, it fulfills character development for Shasta and it allows the other characters to show concern as they're watching and it builds their character. I feel like I would just be preaching to the choir. So why don't you be the Debbie Downer?
Sure. Okay. My screen name's Glumpuddle, you know, that's what I'm here for. So I kind of had this moment on the train kind of rereading this chapter in preparation for this episode. One thing I realized is that I'm always a little bit blurry on this section of the book. That was one of the reasons why I thought maybe the most impressive moment in our Stump and Arnie Weber competition was when Dot found the, what color was the Narnia banner or whatever it was on the way to Anvard.
That was pretty impressive. It's like, he just boom, page,
I know,
or whatever.
She right
like
there.
She had the page memorized or something.
Yeah, and like to me, it was. I don't think I would have needed a couple minutes to find that because I'm just a little blurry on this part of the book of how exactly it unfolds. It kind of feels like okay, the real Shasta has accomplished his real mission, which is to deliver the message, and then it's almost like Lewis had this problem of, well, what do I do with Shasta now? There obviously has to be a battle. That's the whole point, is that Shasta was there to deliver the message to prevent Anvard from being overtaken. So there's the story necessitates that there be a battle, but well, do I just have Shasta sleep through it? No, that doesn't really feel right for the protagonist. How do I get him there?
I don't know. That's what Bilbo did during the Battle of Five Armies. I mean,
that's true. He just
Tolkien said, what do I do with Bilbo? He'll just fall asleep through it.
Okay, before I get to the Debbie Downer stuff, I mean, there's stuff in Chapter 12 that I like quite a bit that does make the battle a lot better. Like, for example, the food, you know, the bacon and eggs. Shasta comes to the Narnians, who are really careless. I love that little tidbit. Remember, because it talks about in Prince Caspian, is it Prince Caspian, where it's like, you know, Narnia at that time was in some disarray when the Telmarines came in. It makes sense. Yeah, these are the Narnians that if their kings and queens were to suddenly disappear, they would have a difficult time kind of getting their stuff together. So it makes sense how slow they are in trying to figure out, well, we better call so-and-so, we better call so-and-so, we better deliver a message, that whole Anvard is being attacked right now thing. But I love the emphasis on the physical details. First off, he does in fact knock Shasta out here for like a day and a half or so, because I love the awareness of, wait a minute, Shasta hasn't eaten in like 2 days, and of course he's exhausted, and it solves a story problem. You know, Lewis is going, okay, the message is on its way. It's going to take a day or two for the Narnians to get there. What do I do with Shasta? Just have him wait around? Well, I'll just have him fall asleep. And that actually, and that makes sense. And feed him. That makes sense. And I love the, it's good having it before the battle to just remind the audience that these are human beings and Shasta's hungry and he's tired and he has this craving for bacon and eggs. And I think a lot of us reading it are like, wow, Shasta doesn't know what bacon and eggs are. Can you imagine that? And we were with him. Like, can you imagine being that old, having bacon and eggs for the first time? And so it gets us really, because it's like food and sleep and drink and things that we can very easily relate to. I think it just reminds us that this is a fragile human being here. It's a great thing to really emphasize and remind the audience of before a battle starts, where we start being concerned for their safety. So that's really good. And even a lot of the discussion with Corin, where it's, of course, Corin wants to be in the battle. And by the way, there's a really good narrator bit where Corrin and Thornbutt the dwarf, because Corrin, of course, wants to fight in the battle, and Thornbutt has been assigned with saying, no, I'm here to make sure you don't fight in the battle. They have a scuffle, and Thornbutt sprains his ankle. A real fight is about to start, but there's a great narrator moment. Lewis writes, "But it was never fought out. That's the worst of fights on a rough hillside." And it's this oddly specific thing that I guess this narrator has experience with. It's like this old saying he's quoting, like, yeah, that's what happens when there's a fight on a hillside. It never does quite get fought out. Okay, I'll take your word for it. Then there's a darker one later in the battle, actually, another narrator bit where Lewis says that horses tread less on humans than one would think. And Lewis, of course, fought in World War I. He would know a thing or two about horses in battle. And that's kind of a throwaway line that's in there. So there's a lot of build up to the battle and a couple things in it that I think are really, really cool. But on the whole, it does kind of feel like, why does Shasta even fight in the battle? I don't quite buy it. I don't even know quite what Lewis is trying to do. Is he almost trying to say, well, Shasta is so clueless, he doesn't really understand what he's getting into. So he's just like, oh, okay, I'll go along with it. I didn't really buy it. I thought Shasta would be a little more intelligent than that. I think they could have sold it a little bit better.
What happens to Shasta here is, and actually that I'm kind of describing it in the passive verb tense, what happens to Shasta as opposed to what Shasta does. And that is something that a lot of authors would typically try to avoid, is they want their heroes active in the story, active protagonists. I mean, that was why Peter Jackson made the controversial move to kill off Aragorn in the Two Towers, spoiler alert, and have him make an effort to return to the battle because he felt like he was being carried along into the battle too much.
And even Frodo at the crack of doom plays a little more of a role in the what happens to the ring.
And so I think I understand what you're saying there with Shasta kind of getting pulled in.
Now, there was the comment, though, was it Natalie who said the thing about, Shasta is just kind of getting, to an extent, carried along, and things are just working out because there's this, higher kind of purpose, higher power at play here. And this sounds a lot like The Hobbit, the more I think about it. And it works very well in The Hobbit. I think it works very well here, too, up until this point where it's almost like it just feels a little bit like filler. Like, well, we have to have a battle at the end here. And that's the only reason it really happens is because, well, we have to. The real story's over. Shasta's delivered the message, and he saved Anvard.
I guess I don't have
any real solutions for this. I might have done the same thing in Lewis's position.
I guess I kind of see what you're saying, except I would say it benefits the story. I will grant you that it probably benefits the story least for Shasta. I think it benefits the story most, probably in this order. First for Erebus to wonder if Shasta's died.
You mean the way Lewis separates them?
Yes, the way that it is separated, okay. And the way that she's wondering if Shasta has died before they can reconcile.
And it's credible that she'd be humbled. I guess we'll get to more of that in the next chapter.
Yeah, but
like getting that day to kind of just sort of wallow in it, you know?
He's not exactly a very round character in the story, but it does build up the story of, or the character of Corrin. Further establishes and solidifies him as actually no, this kid is not all talk. He's all talk and all walk. And then I think it also it gives us an interesting perspective into I like seeing kind of the adult Pevensey children fleshed out. Like, well,
yeah, it's true.
Peter goes off and he'll fight his own war against giants. Edmund will lead a battle against, to defend an ally. Lucy will be right there at his side fighting in battle.
And I love how Lewis, really quick, I love how Lewis handles it where if Lewis had written this as book one, where Shasta's the main character and these Peter, Susan, Edmund, Lucy, those are relatively minor characters in the story as far as what the focus of the story is, I think he would write them just about the same. Like, he doesn't put too much emphasis on them. Mm-hmm. I think if this was your first Narnia book, you wouldn't necessarily know that these are the main characters in the other books.
Yeah. Yeah. You wouldn't necessarily know that, Lucy's a huge character in three more stories.
And so it keeps us in Shasta's headspace. Yeah. I love that.
So I think that it does serve the story. I think it does build up the characters. It does flesh out the world. And I think it benefits the story. I do agree with you that it is an inevitable portion of the story. Like, it has to happen. But you know what? I think that I think a lot of things have to happen. I think Shasta has to meet Aslan. I think Shasta has to be reunited with Corrin after they meet in Teshban. So I think just because it's inevitable, I don't think it means it's filler. And so I see what you're saying. I think if it did nothing else except kind of drag Shasta into a battle, I would probably agree with you. But I think because there's so many other things going on that I'm going to say I like the battle. And I think one of the weird things about it as we think about it is because now we're in the Narnia Netflix world, a new era in Narnia webdom. But I think we're also kind of constantly thinking, how would this be adapted?
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, I think that, like, I appreciate, I don't know how if it would work as an adaptation, but, like, for a movie, but I do appreciate how Lewis tries to do, you know, it puts a surprising perspective when he does battles. I mean, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's just surprising that, I mean, how many battles end with another army coming to the rescue? But this one is, in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's told from the point of view of the people who are doing the rescuing, and I like that. In the single combat in Prince Caspian, it's really the spectators who are narrating, which is, it's not Lewis describing what's happening, it's the spectators saying, oh, did you see that? I missed it. And Cornelius at one point even says, like, oh, my old eyes missed it. What happened? And they're describing it. And so, like, getting those characters' perspectives and reactions to what's going on is a more emotionally involving way to do it in a book. And, of course, he's doing that here, too. We're getting the play-by-play of the Hermit, and we're getting Erebus and Bree saying, but what about Shasta? Is Shasta okay? And so we get their perspective on we get what's happening, and we get their perspective at the same time. And of course, Lewis, again, even says it in the book. He says something like, but there's no point in describing the battle from Shasta's point of view, because he didn't really have a lot of idea what actually happened. I do like how transparent Lewis is about it. It's like, okay, this is going to be boring. You're not going to have no clue what's going on. Let me go somewhere else. So there's aspects of it that I really appreciate it. And of course, the Rabadash thing is awesome. So there's aspects of it. I love it. But there's also a sense of, well, the story is essentially over, mm-hmm. with Shasta delivering the message. Now we got to have our battle. But then again, there's elements I like. So I don't know. Maybe I should just stop being a killjoy. Stop being such a glummy puddle.
Nice. See what you did there. I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Thanks.
So here's something I do like that Lewis does with this battle. And I remember one of my friends, I don't know if she'd ever read The Lion, the Witch, the Wardrobe. Maybe as a kid. And then she saw the movie when it came out in 2005. God, that was 14 years ago. And I said, oh, so what do you think? She goes, I enjoyed it. It was a good movie. I always question stories where they think that dropping adolescent children into a world and making them the supreme rulers will just, you know, benefit the whole country. And she was partly drawing on, like, oh yeah, you just drop Peter and Edmund into this battle and they do just fine. Which is not actually how all the books go. They actually are more normal children. Kind of like Peter rises to the occasion. He fights the witch, but it's not at all this. It's not even really like the movies. Like, the only reason that Peter does so well in Prince Caspian is because the Narnian air affects him, and he's kind of becomes again who he was before. Uh-huh. And he starts to remember his old skill, and he's not just a child anymore. And that's why he's kind of a different... So, like, the children behaving a certain way, like in Prince Caspian or Voyage of the Dawn Treader, they can behave a certain way, and there's actually a logical explanation for it. And it's not like... I think I am glad that Lewis doesn't just throw Shasta into the battle and then, oh, and Shasta killed two Calormans and Shasta's doing, you know.
Well, because that's what Lewis does in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where Peter, you know, he's fighting so fast with the witch, it looked like three swords and three knives, says something like that. In the fairy tale context of the story, I completely buy it. I've never really questioned that. And I thought they did a pretty good job selling it in the movie as well. Like, when Peter fights the witch and the emotional context of it.
The emotional context is good. And at least they did intentionally depict it like the witch is kind of toying with him. Like, she's not really challenged by him, which is important.
Yeah. And you're right that, it's got to give Lewis credit for not making Shasta a hero, making him kind of the opposite in that. It would have kind of flied in the face of everything that came before it to have Shasta kind of going along with what Natalie said. It would have to have Shasta suddenly be this great warrior and saves the day. No, the point is that Shasta, apparently by chance, apparently by total coincidence, kept getting lucky, or really unlucky, that turned out it was actually luck, that he's not it for him to suddenly be the hero and save the day would just fly in the face of all that.
The hermit said there's no such thing as luck, so.
Or well, he said he's never encountered such a thing as luck. It's all in the wording. So yeah, there's things I appreciate about this, and just the way that I think that the hermit thing, like the reason Lewis had him in there and had him narrating the battle, I just think it was because battles in books are, when you just sort of describe them, this happened and that happened and that happened, there's just something tedious about it. I even think the Lord of the Rings battles in the book are kind of tedious to read. I just kind of, Pelennor Fields, I just kind of skim through. They're really well done in the movies, I think. Just a great fundamental difference between book and films, I guess. But the way Lewis adds a perspective on it, I think, is him trying to solve a problem. And it's partially successful, but not 100%, in my opinion.
I do think that,
on the whole,
I do think that one of the, you hit on one of the really good things that Lewis does, which I saw but never really picked up on, which is he does describe battles through the emotional experiences of the people participating or viewing it. And I heard a line actually today that I guess this author was describing how great crime novels are written. And the author said, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but basically said, the great crime novels aren't about how cops work their cases. The great crime novels are about how the cases affect the cops. And I thought, that's interesting. And that's really how Lewis describes a lot of his battles. It's not about, well, here's what this character does throughout the battle. It's really about how characters are reacting and reacting to, you know, acting and reacting to what's going on and their emotional experiences through it. Which, of course, we know that Lewis had a very intimate knowledge of. For those who don't know, like I think Douglas Gresham has talked about how C.S. Lewis had nightmares, you know, throughout his life from his experiences in World War One, and he was known as someone who's a very jolly, jovial, joking type of person. It's not like he was this person who was just a glum puddle to be around.
Yeah, you know. Oh, heavens no, heavens no.
But he was someone who understood the true highs and lows of life's experiences.
Uh huh. Did have something just occur to me, which I didn't have to follow up that statement with this, but is Edmund slightly hypocritical for, now I know that he's charged with, you know, protecting, and Corin's not his son, so he's not really his choice maybe, but is Edmund slightly hypocritical for making such a fuss about sending boys into battle?
Yeah. I don't know how else to respond right now.
Like in the book, he tells Corin, he says something like, you know, young boys that fight are a danger only to their own army or something like that.
Well, and, let's see. Did Lewis think
it turned out pretty good for you and Peter, you know?
How old was Edmund in Lewis's timeline for Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
Corin was older. Edmund was about 10, I think. Corin's like 13 or 14.
Yeah, I'd say he's pot calling the kettle black.
So, yeah, I think it turned out.
Or maybe he's going to say, it didn't go well for me either. I got stabbed, if you recall. So maybe not. Maybe he said, I learned my lesson.
Maybe not.
Do as I say, not as I did.
Exactly. For the record, I don't. I wish there wasn't so much negativity about this. I love this book. And I'm going to have some awesome things to say, some more awesome things to say in the next chapter. But I was thinking that. You know, every so often I kind of reevaluate, well, is Dawn Treader still my favorite book? And it always comes down to, well, is it Dawn Treader or Horse and His Boy? Because, wow, I love Horse and His Boy. And I think what it ends up coming down to is Horse and His Boy doesn't quite stick the landing. I think it has a nice ending we're going to get to in a second here. But this battle is one of the things that it doesn't quite land perfectly for me. Whereas Dawn Treader, it ends at just the right moment. And it all... The theme of the story comes together.
It's
so emotional.
It's such an
ends at just the
ending.
Right moment.
And also, there is some evidence that Lewis kind of thought he was concluding a trilogy at that point, too.
Yeah.
And so he was writing it differently. Doesn't mean that, yeah, I'm with you. Voyage of Dawn Treader is my favorite book. So you're preaching to the choir there.
Right. And we do, I mean, there's great stuff in here that I love. We have to talk about Rabadash really quick. Just that whole thing is so, I mean, obviously we have this, and again, on a conceptual level, I love that, on a thematic level, I love that Rabadash thought this was going to be his moment of glory. actually it's his biggest humiliation. And Shasta, it ends up being more Shasta's moment of glory in that when it's over, at the end of the battle, and I love it, Shasta's looking around and can't figure out why everyone is looking at him and cheering and stuff. And at the end, it's really Shasta who's being, oh, the next king of Arkenland is here. And that's kind of the punchline of the battle. And it's Rabadash's humiliation. It's that's what we're going to take away from this. So I love that on a thematic level. I love that that's where it comes. And I love seeing Rabadash hanging from that spike.
I will say, humiliated. I got to give one of my pet peeves. For those who don't know, I love studying medieval history, and I'm a historical fencer. And so I like studying about like real old battles and stuff. In fact, I have a little like a pocketbook sized version of like almost every like a short summary of every famous Scottish battle. But it bugs me that like Rabadash really thought 200 horse would work. Like really, I kind of get it. Like, well, it's going to take my surprise. I'm thinking, because even in the book, remembering in the book, thinking, yeah, 500 horse might work. Oh, well, it's only 200. You know,
we don't know what the walls are like. You know, it's peacetime. You know, they probably don't have the electric fence turned on. You know,
like the one in Jurassic Park.
I was about to say,
hold on to your butts.
Anyway, that was one of my. Which I like that he's like, well, it didn't work. Yeah, he got too impatient. Now he's, you know, he should have just, you know, done this or that instead of, you know, bungling it. But
I love how Lewis says in Teshban, everyone always took him seriously, and I love that like he's this lunatic who doesn't know he's a lunatic because everyone's treating him like a prince, even though he's a lunatic. And then as soon as he leaves Teshban, it's wow, like he realizes, I don't know if he totally realizes it, but all of a sudden he doesn't look so impressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. But I guess we'll see if we can wrap this up in the next episode. Maybe not.
We'll see. There's going to be a lot to discuss.
In the
next commentary episode. There's going to be a lot to discuss for sure. Yeah. But it's interesting that we've been discussing Lewis and battles and his experience in World War One, because that kind of ties into something else that we want to discuss.
And now it's time for something else. The part of the show where Narnia Webbers talk about something else.
So are we cheating a bit here? Because this still feels, the idea is to kind of, for something else, is to sort of, let's go into left field. You know, let's go somewhere totally different.
Something completely different. But it does tie in actually a lot.
We are cheating a bit here.
We're talking about the new Tolkien trailer.
At the time of this recording, it's new, yes.
Journeys we take to prove ourselves. It's got adventures.
We should form a club, a brotherhood.
We change the world through the power of art.
Music, poetry.
And what about Tolkien?
I want to write something.
It's about magic beyond anything anyone has ever felt before.
You definitely know more about Lord of the Rings than I do. You probably know a little more about Tolkien than I do.
I've only read one Tolkien biography.
Okay.
It's called Architect of Middle Earth, and it is he had a very interesting life, interesting story. A lot of people will know that the Beren Lúthien or Aragorn Arwen situation kind of mirrors his own life a little bit, because it was a little bit of a, his tombstone for he and his wife says Beren and Lúthien. But this is a story of his young life, and it looks like it's going to pretty much depict him as a young man in at university and meeting his wife. And I don't know how far into his life it actually goes, though.
Yeah, I don't see any mention of Lewis. I've looked through IMDb to see if there's any C.S. Lewis. I looked all around. It doesn't look like Lewis is going to be in the movie as far as I can tell. But I guess, again, you know, you probably know a little. You've read one Tolkien biography, which is one more than I've read. But it's what I do know about his life doesn't never sounded particularly dramatic to me. And looking at the trailer, it looks like they're really over dramatizing it. And they're going to do that thing that I hate in biopics, I think, where it's, he's playing with a bottle cap or something. That's where he got the idea for the ring. And then he sees the bomb go off in the war. That's where he got the idea for Barad-dûr. And I guess it's because it just isn't usually that simple. And so I always laugh when I see the movie like this is Hollywood.
Yeah.
And so that's what strikes me. It just looks very, very drama. Like very, very dramatic.
It does, yeah. It doesn't look bad. It looks interesting. I mean, it's one of those things where it's hardly the best trailer I've ever seen. And I mean, you and I know that there's sometimes trailers where I've seen trailers, I thought, I will never ever see this movie. Then you see the movie, oh my goodness, it's so good.
Yeah, it could be.
And then there's other times where if you watch the trailer for Star Trek and then Into Darkness, they think these are going to be the best sci-fi films of all time. And they were good, but not the best of all time. I think it looks interesting. I agree that, yeah, they're kind of trying to, oh, there's the Balrog on the field on No Man's Land in World War I.
Right.
We'll just have to see. I guess I'm kind of glad that they're not just capitalizing on the Lewis Tolkien friendship because their social circles do get... Their social circles, as historians talk about them, because they were friends and they were both members of the Inklings. I think their social circles are both oversimplified. Lewis and Tolkien were good. Yes, they were friends, but you know what? They had a large circle of friends. I think it's probably going to discuss some of his, I think really focus on his friendships and time at university, which it was interesting. When I was at in Oxford in October, I was having lunch with Dr. Michael Ward, and he said, oh, have you seen the new Tolkien exhibition? I said, no. And he said, no, you've got to go. And then I went to this thing in Oxford, and it was one of the most incredible exhibitions I've ever seen. It was about the Lord of the Rings, but also about Tolkien and his life. And there were letters from his old tutors at Oxford, like one of them saying, there is no one in the world at his age who is as gifted at language as he is. Just stunning. And so it'll probably, I think, draw on that. But sometimes I wonder, are they just going to oversimplify how much they tie in a story? And that's one thing I do appreciate about Shadowlands, even though people have talked about how it's not the most accurate depiction of C.S. Lewis. It's a very accurate emotional depiction in terms of what he went through in his life.
Yeah.
But it's not his demeanor and the way he lived. It's not like
right. He
was just a different type of person.
I think it's a good movie about the using a fictional version of C.S. Lewis to kind of explore a lot of the themes that Lewis explored in his works. It's faithful to that, but not to the historical details of his life.
But I also like how in Shadowlands, it's not just Narnia this and Narnia that and space trilogy.
Right,
years,
yep.
This is a story of the person. And of course, you can see the Narnia books are kind of in the background there, but they're not just thrown into the face of the viewer.
Right.
Which it looks like they will probably be doing with the Tolkien movie. I mean, even the trailer, when they show the text Tolkien,
There's the ring.
I get it.
You can imagine how much his name. Tolkien himself would hate this just from the term of the trailer. I mean, he always, I understand he would get upset and people would try to say, the stories were about World War I or something like that. Which is obviously what this movie is doing. It's trying to say, you see, this came from that, and that came from this. And I think that would probably drive him crazy.
And he even talked about my adorable, deplorable fans. I think it was a phrase that he used. And it's interesting because I do think that Tolkien did not like his entire life's significance being reduced to his producing the work of The Lord of the Rings. And I think that that is an injustice to the man. I think that he would be... or was frustrated at that. And he did a lot of work. He did a whole story of King Arthur. And I mean, there's a lot of things that this man did. And I understand that he was a decent human being. And sometimes people, famous authors, just get reduced to becoming great artists. And, I even remember one thing that stuck with me because a lot of the details of his life, I don't remember just because it was a long time since I read the book, but one thing always stuck with me where one of his children said, no matter how busy he was, because he was always very busy, if you walked into the room and wanted to talk to him, he would instantly stop whatever he was doing and he would make you the most important thing going on right then and listen to what you had to say. And that stuck with me. And I remember thinking, I'm going to try to do that with my children.
I would love it if the movie would kind of capture that. I think oftentimes they kind of portray these geniuses when they make these biopics, they portray them as these slightly weird or there's something off about them because he realized if they made something so amazing, they couldn't have just been a normal person, right? They must have been something a little off about them, maybe in a great way. But it'd be cool if he was just a normal guy, and so we'll see how they do that.
Yeah. So what I will be, I mean, this is in my list of, I will see how the critics review it. Yeah, I'll look at the reviews. And but here's, honestly though, even if it's 98% on Rotten Tomatoes, I'll probably wait for it to come out on Netflix.
Oh, if it's 98%, I'll go. I think I'll probably check it out.
I mean, I might go see it. We'll see. It will depend on what people are saying, because maybe they're doing a great job showing, oh my goodness, this is so cool how they tied the Balrog into the tanks, you know,
we'll,
and the planes are the Nazgul. This is so cool.
Oh,
it's so,
so
well
perfect.
Done. So I may, we'll see. It just depends on kind of what they're saying, not just how positively they're reviewing it.
Okay. Well, if we see it, we'll report back.
Take the outro, my friend.
It's mine. I wrote it. It's mine. You've been listening to Talking Beasts, an ArnieWeb.com podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider sharing it with a friend. And be sure to subscribe and post a comment below or in the Talking Beast Facebook group. You can also email us at podcast@narniweb.com, rillian@narniweb.com, or glumpuddle@narniweb.com. Special thanks to AJ Aiken. For the latest Narnia Netflix news, visit narniweb.com. Until next time, further up and further in. And Rillian's trying to make me laugh. This is why we're not doing any more video podcasts.